serious, man. You cannot be serious.
We've had some great guests on You Cannot Be Serious, but we thought, didn't we, Mick and Don, at the into the second day of the Australian Open, who better would it be than to speak to an absolute star, an Australian champion, a Wimbledon champion, and get his thoughts on tennis and everything else that's going on, and he is the great Pat Cash. Welcome, Pat, to You Cannot Be Serious.
Thank you. That was a very kind introduction, actually.
I could have gone right through all the tournaments you've won.
No.
The first question, and they say I hog the questions, but I'm just doing
it. It's your show, remember.
It's not my show. Mm-hmm. I just want to ask this first up. You rated number 4 in the world in 1988. What I want to know is who were the three people ahead of you?
Oh, actually, you know, that's a good question. Well, Lendl for sure, Villander. And Edberg, was it?
Mm. Now, and you beat, in 1987, you beat Lendl in
the final.
Wimbledon final. Yeah. And here's, didn't you?
Yeah, and I lost to Edberg at Kooyong at the beginning of 87.
In Kooyong, still there.
Yeah, Kooyong. That was the last one on the grass. So I played the last match on the grass, well, tournament match. I played Davis Cup, I think, since then. And then lost the first one at Melbourne Park, which was Flinders Park then.
Yes. Who to, Pat?
Yeah.
Who to at Melbourne?
To Villander. Both five sets. The Villander one was 8-6 in the fifth. It's a bit of a heartbreaker, really. But I played well. So, you know, you kind of walk off those ones and go, yeah, you're bitterly disappointed. But you think, you know, I actually gave it all and I played just about as well as I could.
So you didn't
under
crack
the
it,
circumstances.
Because you were seen by lots of people that be fiery and have a temper. Did you crack it when you lost a big one?
No, I think at that stage I'd pretty much got over that sort of thing, you know, I suppose. I've got to be honest, I know people say that, you know, kind of knowing me, particularly in Australia, know me as, you know, somebody got angry with the umpires or angry with myself or whatever. I can honestly say in my whole career, I only lost one match from losing my temper.
When was that?
That was early on. It was the US Open. I got absolutely screwed by, funny enough, American umpires against an American.
In that game at
I learned my lesson, I think. I really lost it.
In that game against Lendl at Wimbledon, you're very relaxed.
I wouldn't say I was relaxed, but I'd done a lot of sports psychology stuff, which was sort of just coming in then. It was a sort of a new thing. Luckily, I had a really good physio, David Zucca, who was the Olympic physio, and he knew some guys, sports psychologists, that were, it was a new sort of thing that was coming in. And so I grabbed the Olympic sports psychologist, a guy called Jeff Bond, from, he was in Canberra. And I did a lot of work with him.
So it wasn't a joint before the game or after the game that got you through?
No. I got to be honest, that was maybe a generation before, but before me.
So when you were, you might disagree with this, but there's three main male tennis players at the minute, Nadal, Federer and Djokovic. They seem to be, you had to contend with a hell of a lot more seriously good players in those days, didn't you?
Well, I'd say it's different. I think there's a lot of seriously good players now. What they're unbelievably good at what they do. I suppose in my era there was so many different styles and so many different types of courts. Clay courts were slow. The fast indoor courts were really fast. The grass was really fast. The hard court could be anywhere from slow to whatever. So it depends on what your style were. If you were Henri Leconte, you were to tackle John McEnroe, you know, you'd sort of, you know, you come to the draw and you say, oh, I want to draw these guys. And you play in an indoor court and you would. And you think, oh, I'm in trouble. And then you, likewise on the clay court, you've played Villander or say Lendl. Lendl, you know, he really covered a lot of area, and that's he was very good on all surfaces.
Yeah.
That's why he was number one for so long, as was McEnroe. And Edberg was obviously a great fast court player, but he was a very good clay court player too, got to the final of French Open. So you tend to – it was more court specialists.
Yep.
And then – so therefore you'd be in trouble if you weren't really ready for it.
The game's changed a lot since you played. Mm. Equipment and also the size of the players.
Yeah.
They're much bigger nowadays, aren't they?
Generally speaking, they're monsters, yeah. That's right. The I'd say when I came on the circuit at 6 foot, I was regarded as sort of medium to large. I mean, I'm absolute midget in the locker room these days. These guys are 6'10". There's a couple of guys 6'10". There's 7 foot. I think Opelka is 7 foot. There's still typically the best players are Nadal, Djokovic, Federer. They're all 6'1", 6'2", because they can move. And they've, the days of the really tall guys who couldn't move are gone. It was like when you see it, we had a guy who was 6'9", called Milan Schreiber. He was a Czech player, or Czechoslovakia as he was then. And he had a monster serve, but he couldn't move. So it was like, okay, just get his serve back, you'll be okay. But that's not the case these days.
Pat, you were brilliant in the front half of the court. Could you play the same game today?
No. No, I think I would like to still come in and put pressure. And I think that's a real dying art, is the gamesmanship, tactical on the court. Federer is obviously a master at it. He will sneak in. He'll hit these balls. And the guy hitting a shot and he looks up and Federer's on top of the net. Nadal is good at it, very good at it. As I said, Federer is kind of a master of it. And they're very old school tactics. They're pretty much what we
used
to do.
Is that serving? Are you talking about serving volley or different?
Serving volley or just getting into the net and utilizing the net and putting the pressure on the opponent. Because if the guy's not coming in, there's no pressure for him to hit the ball deep or hit the ball to length. If the guy's at the net, it puts the baseliner their sights off a little bit. Because they're not sure if they hit the ball deep, hit the ball short at the guy's feet who's coming in, and that is just enough to unsettle players. And Federer does that, to perfection, and he's probably the only one who does it really, really well.
What about as far as longevity in the game, or retaining energy, or whatever else? To me, hitting the ball 20 times from the baseline is going to take more energy than running in and trying to put away serve and volley. Why don't they go serve and volley?
Well, it's a different sort of movement. In actual fact, to be able to sprint to the net and lunge two or three times and go back for a smash is much tougher than shuffling along the baseline and hitting 5 or 6 or 10 ground strokes. Having said that, the rallies go longer. So it's more of an aggressive type of sport, the serve volleying. It's really tough on the body. But the bottom line is, with the slow courts, the racket the equipment that one of you guys mentioned, the string technology, the ball, the spin that the gets on that these guys get on the ball these days is incredible. So you are almost a sitting duck unless you hit a perfect volley. They can whip the ball over your head. I mean, I swear that when I first saw these strings come out and I'm playing against guys, they would hit. I'd be at the net. They'd hit a lob over my head, and I'd go. I turn around and go, well, that's going to be 3-4 feet out. And I just look over my head and I'd go, holy bloody thing just dropped in by about a foot. How is that possible?
That's strings, is it? Just
that's
purely the strings.
That's purely the strings.
That's extraordinary.
So it's made the court bigger, shall we say. So you can hit the ball harder and the ball will drop.
So a man who won Wimbledon purely by just serving his bloody ring, or it was Goran Ivanišević.
Yeah.
Is there too much importance placed on someone with a big serve? Because he had not really anything else, did he?
Well, no. He had a big forehand and a backhand, and he volleyed pretty solidly. There was an era there that was massive servers, wasn't there? The courts were still quick. We had Sampras, we had Ivanišević, we had Rozetsky, we had Krajicek. Maybe the greatest era of servers we've ever seen. They all came at the same time and they just blasted the serve. And it became kind of boring, but it was very, very effective.
Well, take us through beating Lendl. Now, what was the psych about the Wimbledon final, beating Lendl, the man at the top of his game, and was there any psych in it? Did you speak to him? Did you, when you crossed and sat down at the end of games, did you? Was there anything going on mentally with him?
Well, there is a big mental battle there. Ivan was probably his worst surface was grass, shall we say. I mean, he was number one player in the world. He'd been in the final the year before, lost to Becker. But I knew that I just had to, you know, he was not comfortable at the net as long as I could make him volley. And in those days on the grass courts, you basically had to volley. There's no way you could stay back against an attacking player and win. So he was sort of forced to play a style that he didn't really like to play. There was not any love lost between us, I've got to be honest.
Really?
From a long time previously.
Why?
I had a respect for the guy. Just some things that happened.
Come on now, Pat.
Well, he was very loud. Ivan was very loud. There's certain players.
Off the court, he was off loud.
Off the court in the locker room, yeah. You guys have been in locker rooms. You know the types of personalities there are. There's the loud ones. There's the ones that, you know, get in your face. There's the quiet ones that you got to watch out for. There's white line fever guys. There's all that sort of stuff. And Lendl was loud. He was, you know, the king of the jungle. He was number one player in the world. He used to thump his chest and tell jokes and various things like that, and pull pranks on people and make fun of people. And, you know, a typical thing would be you'd walk in the locker room and I don't know, Linda would see you and just go, "What the hell are you wearing, Cash? You look like an idiot with those shorts. You look like an idiot.
Really?
What the hell? Where did you buy them? Kmart?" You know, that would be the sort of thing. Yeah, hey, good morning, Ivan. You know, that would be the sort of stuff that you'd do, and then that would go on from there. So he was always trying to give.
So
you were trying to prepare yourself for a game. So you'd go into yourself, and he was out there. You know, out there, that's the way he prepared for his game.
Yeah, that's right.
He'd be talking,
he'd be joking with people, he'd be sort of loud and brash, and that was his personality. But
you, what, did you go into yourself before you
went I didn't care too much about that. Yeah, I was pretty quiet.
You weren't too shy, though.
No, I wasn't. Well, if somebody was in my face, I'd get in their face. I had no problems with that. I think that's probably Aussie rules background, you know. I wouldn't really start the fight, but, you know, Ivan would start the fight by saying, "You look like an idiot with that claws," first thing in the morning. "Or that racket, that is shit. You cannot hit a ball with that racket. Cash, your forehand is crap."
That's very good.
Now, I've heard it a lot.
The Wimbledon final,
yes.
You broke tradition at the All England Club, didn't you?
Yes.
You won the event, and then I think it was the first time in history, you decided to just make your way to your box and climb
I
up.
I did, yeah.
Now, what possessed you? Was that just spontaneous?
It wasn't really, but it did appear to be that way. I'd sort of thought about it a few months before. Just for some reason, it just came into my mind. I wonder why nobody's climbed through the stands.
You thought, if I win Wimbledon, this is what I'll do.
That's exactly what I did.
Well, that's extraordinary.
And then I thought, why hasn't anybody ever done that? And I said, yeah. And when I win this year, I'm going to do that. And that was about as much as I thought you were
confident you were going to win this year.
Yeah, I believed I was going to win. I mean, things had to fall into place, but I was playing well. I think it was probably around April that I was starting to think that. And I didn't think about it really until the night before. And I went sitting there just back there watching a movie. It was a really strange household at that stage. I sort of new house, new baby. Fiance who was pretty insecure about everything that was going on and wasn't sure, you know, as a stressed out mum.
Is this A.B. Christensen?
Yeah, Anna Britt, that's right.
A.B., we call her.
So I had my coach in the house, Barkers, and then had a sports psychologist, and they were sort of, they were around trying to keep things nice and quiet. But she's Norwegian, strong, Scandinavian girl, and it would be, you know, you wouldn't expect dinner to be on the table. You always have to make it yourself or whatever. But you know, everybody was sort of towing the line. The tension was really there. And she said, "The backyard needs cleaning, needs mowing." Not a big backyard by any means. And all of a sudden, everybody's hand went up. "I'll do it." You know, it was like, just keep everything calm and quiet. And I just sort of sat there and watched a movie and Charles Bronson blowing a few people away and Murphy's Law, I think it was, you know, and I just visualizing everything we did with the sports psychologist. I just visualized everything that could happen on the day. And it worked really, really well. You know, so we visualized walking out onto the court, which is a really nerve-wracking moment, and settling really well. Bad line calls, wind, sun, crowd against me, crowd for me, Lendl coming back, me serving double file. You know, everything that it could possibly be, I visualized that. And it was really like I'd been on the – I had played a Wimbledon final before. It worked really well. That was one of my strengths. I was very good at visualizing stuff like that.
One thing that's fascinated me about you guys, the entourage that goes with you. How much you treat it as a business. I know it's probably different nowadays to when your time costs have gone up, but how much does it cost to keep this entourage going on a yearly basis?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean,
well, how much it cost you a percentage of your winnings?
You know, I wouldn't know.
50% of your winnings?
No, it wouldn't be that much. But I had part-time. I had coach full-time. So he had a full-time wage. He had a very successful business out at Heatherdale Tennis Club here in Melbourne. So I had to sort of pry him away from that. So whatever that would be, I can't remember, what, 100 grand or something back in those days maybe for the year to keep him going. And then I had part-time Dr. Anne Quinn, who travelled with me to training, part-time Jeff Bond, a sports psychologist. So, and then I had the physio from time to time, David Zook, come over just to be around. So, you know, paid him a few bucks. But these days, the guys are there. They've got a full-time, you know, three or four people, you know. But money is really big.
Your earnings were $1.9 million in total.
Total, that's right. Yeah.
So that's how much it's changed.
Well, no, let's fast forward. There was two tours there, so a lot of these money, and there was a lot of exhibition tournaments. So mm-hmm. we were allowed to play exhibition tournaments, and I think that's one of the problems with the matches players these days. Everybody wants to see them play each other, but when you're getting, you know, Djokovic and Nadal, I think it played 70 times or something.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. I had a short career, lots of injuries, but I think I played Lendl or Villander maybe 10 times.
Let's talk about those three. There's three men who have clearly been dominant for a decade. Mm. My view as an outsider, just looking in, is that Djokovic doesn't get the credits he deserves. Can you rank them for us, Federer, Nadal and Djokovic?
No, I couldn't really rank them because it depends on what the surface is. But I mean, at the moment,
Pat, because you're going to be quoted if you.
Oh, thanks, John.
Yeah, I know exactly. Well, I mean, you've got to say that Djokovic is the best player on clay, which I never would have guessed. I mean, he won. You know, he's been so successful at Wimbledon.
He's got seven Aussies too.
Exactly. I mean, this is a tournament he's been incredibly successful at. It's. You know, head-to-head, Djokovic is the best, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, think so. But it's not as fashionable to like him, is it?
It's not at all. No. I mean, you can't get away with the fact that, you know, Federer, for me, you know, he's the best, most enjoyable player to watch, followed closely by Nadal. I just love his power and, you know, his intensity that he puts on the ball. As we're talking about the top, these three guys. But on, you know... On clay, obviously, Nadal is number one, but you cannot go past the fact that Nadal's record against Federer, even though it's shortening and it will continue to because the way Nadal's tactics are, I don't think, other than clay, I think Federer was wanting to play him because he'll try and shorten that gap. But for the greatest player of all time, as Federer is, or is regarded as, he's two main rivals in his own, in his era, he's got a losing record against.
Correct.
So it's a really quick way to shut down that argument, which I don't like as the greatest player of all time. I've always been against it. And people go, oh, no, Federer. And then you go, well, he's number two rivals. He's got a losing record.
Okay, well, let me put it this
question.
The last one on this. If you were still playing, who would you least like to play out of those three in a Wimbledon final?
Wimbledon? Oh, I was going to say Nadal on clay would have been the biggest nightmare. Yeah. I think Federer because he's the way he served. But he could transcend the fast court or the slow court. So the grass courts, when we were quicker, he'd be very successful, and he's obviously very successful on the slower grass courts, where I think Nadal or Djokovic would not have the same success in our era on grass. There's no way they'd have the same success. No way. But Federer would, without a doubt.
I just still want to speak about you beating Lendl at Wimbledon. So I should know this.
I won't get sick of that. Sorry.
What was the what was the score? What did you beat him?
7-6, 6-2, 7-5.
So when it was apparent that you were probably going to win, did he try and psych you out, or did you just feel supremely confident, like you said the night before?
I did. The first set was crucial. The first set to get that one on the board, which I got in a very tight tiebreaker. Second set, I relaxed. I didn't honestly remember, but I was only told in the press conference afterwards I didn't lose a point on my serve in the whole second set. So I won four games to straight to love. Then there's the danger period, because then you're so confident then you can lose concentration. That's what I did. So Lendl broke me, my serve. And at that stage, on a very hot day, going into a fourth set and then a fifth set is still anybody's game. That's the great thing about these five set matches. There's still anybody's game until the end. So, I was down a break, and I remember sitting down at 4-3 down the break. Was it 5-4? And I looked up to my box there, and the sports psychologist, we had a sort of a kind of a message or a signal, and he would stand up, and that would mean, get going, get fired up. Because it's all about emotional management. If you're too fired up, like, too nervous or excited, like you would be as you're walking onto Wimbledon final, it's to calm down, to breathe, to get your timing, just to concentrate on the ball. And then if you're not pumped up enough and you lose a little bit of focus, then, you've got to fire yourself up. And that's what these guys are great at doing. And I think that was one of my strengths. So he stood up, and it was like, and started clapping. In other words, get fired up. So I jumped out of the chair, ran across to the returning position and started jumping around and firing yourself up. So it worked. I broke serve and held, and then broke again and then held. So I won four in a row.
So just Donald, by far the two most non-contact popular ball sports in the world are golf and tennis. Mm. And it's just ironic that the biggest trophy is the British Open in golf.
Yeah.
And the Wimbledon tennis. So
Do you think the Masters is bigger?
No.
In golf?
Not than the British Open.
Oh, okay. No, I don't follow golf that closely.
I reckon winning in the Open is probably the epitome of a golfer's career, and winning Wimbledon would be the epitome.
Would
you rather win Wimbledon than the Masters, would you? The British Open than the Masters.
Absolutely.
Would you?
Yeah, the British Open. That's where it started.
Do you reckon the golfers think like that?
I do. That's what I think. But it's where
I think
it
depends on where. If you go and talk to the French guys, they will definitely say French Open.
Of course they will.
And the Americans would generally say, but they would always go, oh, yeah, I want to win.
The game started in...
The neutrals are one of
them.
Started
in
Britain, Scotland.
Britain and Wimbledon's the biggest tennis tournament. Yeah. So, Pat.
Yeah.
Anyway. You might be a royalist, I don't know, and it's pretty topical at this stage with who presented the trophy to you at Wimbledon.
I always get
any
this
member
wrong.
Of the royal family.
Or? Yeah, I always get it wrong though. Oh,
the Duchess,
the Duchess, wasn't it?
Don't yeah, say it was no, the it queen. Is Duchess of. Remember that? It's not Gloucester.
Blonde hair.
Duchess of Gloucester, is it?
Yeah, tall.
No, anyway, it doesn't
matter. I get it all mixed up. I've got to be honest. I know I live in London and all that sort of stuff, but I really don't.
You're not a royalist
that much.
Anyway, let's change.
Not a not necessarily though. I do admire them.
Before you go to footy, Donald, and I'm looking forward to your chat with Pat about the footy. One last thing, minor one. Why do women put the second ball up their undies at service?
You'd have to ask them.
There's 300 ball boys there. Why don't they just call for a second ball if they need it?
Well, probably because most 90% of your tennis life is without ball boys. You're playing on practice courts. You're playing as a kid, so you probably just get used to the habit of having the ball there. I mean, yeah, I think Serena turns around because she's been at it for a long time. She turns around and gets a ball every time she wants. But I think it's a practical way of carrying a ball.
Thanks, Pat.
Now, this is more for my information, Pat, because people probably don't know, but those who do know.
You guys played against each other, didn't you?
Yeah, we did.
Did you have a few punch-ups?
Yes.
I've seen a few of yours, Don. I followed you a lot. Crackers Kenyon was always my favourite. I remember you VFL Park with my dad. Right. You slagging him one and then running off. You always should run away from the umpire. My dad used to say, watch Don. He'll hit somebody and he'll run off and the umpire won't be able to chase him. He'll be halfway down the other end of the field. It was a hero to me. It was fantastic. Listen,
now, change the subject. Your dad played at Hawthorn as a full forward. Now, your name came up on countless occasions when I was on match committee by Ivan Moore, Pat Cash to come down and play in the thirds or seconds. John Kennedy always said, leave it to me.
Right.
Now, how good were you and why didn't you come down?
I love footy. It's still my number one sport, Aussie rules, without a doubt. I follow that more than I got to follow tennis because I'm a coach and everything else, but it's my favourite sport to watch. But I'm going to get a chance to see a lot of it. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that tennis kind of took over.
You were at what, De La Salle or St Kevin's?
I was neither. Yeah, Whitefriars. Yeah. We used to play.
Oh, really?
We used to play. Mm-hmm. O'Shaughnessy's boys were. There was Kew Rovers, which used to play at Xavier. Oh. Yeah. So Jamie Morrissey was one of Kew Rovers' boys. I think it just kind of took over. You know, you play under 14.
So from an early age, you were more interested in tennis than football.
I was more interested in footy, but I got better quicker at tennis because you go under 14s, under 15, you know, in footy, you sort of just wait for the next season and 6 months later. In that 6 months, all of a sudden I play the Victorian Open down at Grace Park and I won the damn thing. I beat everybody.
What age were you?
That was probably 15.
Who'd you beat, Pat?
Who did I beat in the final? I can't remember exactly who I beat, but I beat all the guys that were in the top A pennant. I wasn't actually allegedly good enough to be in A pennant, so they put me in B pennant. I'm pretty pissed off about that. So I came to the Victorian Open and I beat everybody, and I said, okay, this is a chance for me to go overseas now, and I got the opportunity to go overseas and play. And try, you're still playing the juniors, but the top juniors, and get a chance maybe to play junior Wimbledon. And you know, when you get a chance to get into junior Wimbledon, as much as you like to go back and have a kick of the footy, you realise my career path has been chosen. And
did you win junior Wimbledon?
I did. I lost the final the first year, and I came back the second year and won it.
And beat?
I beat Henrik Sundström, actually, mm-hmm. Who ended up as a top 10 guy, became top 10. So, you know, Dad sort of said, listen, you know, I'd love you to play footy, but all you need is, you know, a cold, wet day and to get the ball, a soggy ball, you know, waterlogged ball on the end of the finger, and there's the end of your tennis year.
So there's,
you know, and it kind of made sense. And there's some really hot looking Italian girls over there. The first time I went over there and landed in Milan, and jeepers creepers.
Yeah, good decision.
Jeepers creepers. There's a bit of a parallel. Shane Warne says exactly the same thing. He didn't make it into the first grade of cricket for a while, and his main sport was Aussie rules and still is today. He says he'd rather watch that than any cricket game when we had him on, he said. So that's an amazing parallel.
He's a good tennis player, Warney.
Is he?
Yeah, he was top one of the, like number three in Victoria at his age.
Tell me, he's good at that as well.
And he had good serve.
Fucking piss me off that.
Yeah, he's actually good at hit with him. I mean, he sprays him a bit now, but he is. I mean, you can imagine he having good serve, getting the ball over his head like a bowling. So but yeah, there you go.
Intrigued. The only person maybe we haven't asked you is, I noticed John McEnroe said that Nick Kyrgios needed a mentor. I'm not sure if he thought he was the man. He said that he would have been a better player if they'd had that electronic scoring system in where you could tell if the ball was in or out, but he would have been a much more boring player.
McEnroe?
Yes, he said he'd be boring because he wouldn't have been shouting at the umpires. He would have just had to look at the screen and see if the ball was in or out. Now, you've got you're likened to McEnroe, and your dad used to sit in the stand like McEnroe's dad used to sit in the stand. What did you think? What do you make of the McEnroe saga or the enigma he is?
Oh, look, he's a just phenomenal player. I mean, even to this day, we play some legends matches, and every match I shake my head and go, how the hell did you do that? I mean, the control that he had, the feel, it's just really is something. And he didn't look like an athlete, but he was lightning quick. You know, he just picked up the ball. He was, could never get a lob over his head just to get back and for a smash. And he was ruthless competitor, and he used to cheat like a son of a bitch.
Cheat?
Did he?
Oh, hell yeah. He used to call line calls and make, you know, the ball was clearly out or in, and he just to sit up there and argue and just try and put you off. Whether it's cheating or whether it's gamesmanship, there's a fine line, isn't it?
What did you regard of this?
Both, to be honest. I mean, You know, it is. There's no reason for him to call the referee out and have an argument. He never did it when he was winning. He only did it when he was losing, and he knew what was going to happen. People say, why don't you, you know, why don't you just forget about it, you know, and get on with it? And you tried to, but, you know, it's like saying, you know, it's going to happen, and it does happen in the match when you get on top of him.
So he's starting
to
assist,
and don't let him get up. Don't let him get to you. Don't let him. You're looking up at your coach, and your coach is pointing at your head. Concentrate. It's a bit like saying, you know, the old, don't think of a white horse, guys. What did you just think of? A white horse, right? So you don't think, don't get McEnroe get in your head. Don't let McEnroe get in your head. Don't let that son of a bitch get shot. He's in my head. He was incredible competitor. Incredible. And then he was the only player I've ever seen who would scream and yell and get upset and play better the very next point.
So he worked on that as a tactic, do you think? Or was it just innate? It just was born with it?
I think a bit. He's just an unusual character. I don't know.
Could you draw a parallel between that and someone like Maria Sharapova screaming every ball they... No, seriously, people say that puts you off more than anything.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. Yeah. That is very annoying.
You know, when you talk about McEnroe.
I think McEnroe would be a good mentor for Kyrgios, but...
What about the great Nick Kyrgios?
Yeah, there's no shot that kid can't play. And he's a very good athlete. That serve is as good as anything I've seen. Certainly one of the best serves, if not the best serve on the tour, other than the couple of giant guys.
Anything to do with him?
Well, I don't know if he's, willing to listen to anybody. I have some theories that would, I believe things that I think might would help him, but you know, it's
have you offered them?
I've sort of in a back way mentioned it to some of the guys in Tennis Australia. Say, look, if Nick wants some advice, I think I've got some ideas, but you know, whether that gets to him or not. You know, the last thing I heard of he called me allegedly, I don't know, according to somebody, that I made a nice comment about the match that he played against Nadal, and I said, you know, it was a great effort from Nadal, you know, real gentleman all the way through, you know, it was a great fight, and he calls me, oh, good on you, you potato. He called me potato. So he's a name-calling, childlike sort of stuff.
Better than Philippoussis or...?
Well, not at the moment. Philippoussis got a couple of Grand Slams and a couple of Davis Cup wins under his belt.
Could Philippoussis have been better?
Yeah, he could have been. I think Mark could have gone another step.
Why?
Just needed to work a bit harder.
He was lazy?
I wouldn't say lazy, but I think he just needed that extra 10-20%. And we tried to lead him that way. Myself and a co-coach, Gavin Hopper. We worked with him for a bit. So, I think he was on the cusp of breaking through, but he couldn't quite do that. He should have won the US Open in the year he lost to Rafter. We were coaching him. Very strange. He was playing unbelievable tennis, and he got to the final, and he had this sort of bit of a rift with Pat because something about he didn't want to play Rafter didn't want to play doubles with him anymore, and then Pat was the teacher's pet with Nuke and Rochi, who are the Davis Cup, and then Mark didn't really want to play Davis Cup at that stage because they were favoritism, all that sort of stuff, and so he's playing Pat in the final and said, mate, this is, you know, we didn't say as such, we tried to keep it the same game plan, he's beaten everybody, they just keep the same thing, you know, Pat cannot beat you at the back of the court, you're just too strong, which he was, you know, just do the same tactics. And this was the last thing before he walked on the court, 5 minutes before he walked on the court, that were the tactics, that was everything we agreed on. I sit there with my jaw on the floor as he's going a complete different tactics, serving, volleying both balls. But I'm sitting there going, what? I'm looking, I'm saying, what's he doing? He's going to get, you know, and he wins the first set. So I'm sitting there going, well, that's kind of worked, but Rafter's too clever. He'll get on top of that. And eventually he did. He ended up winning the fourth set, 6-love. He won the next three sets. And after I said, mate, What did you do? He said, I was too scared. I was worried that Pat was going to get into the net on me. I said, how's he going to get in the net on him? On you? You're going to smash the ball at the back of the court. He's not going to have a chance to get in the net. Yeah, I suppose you're right, but I, you know, kind of. So you that's don't. The mental aspect. There's a huge element.
He's not coachable.
No, he was coachable. He just panicked, and that's the thing about playing big match condition, big match situations, and you know that I think translates, as we've seen so far, translates to Nick as well. So you can have a super talented player, and I think
mentally they can't handle the pressure or to become good players.
That's what it appears at the moment.
Not pissing in your pocket, but you could get yourself up.
Yeah, well, that's what it appears. I mean, there's a lot of talented players out there, and everybody's got a little weakness. Well, most of them, you know, it's your Federer or Nadal or somebody, but almost everybody's got a weakness of some sort. You know, Nick's weakness is probably he's focused on over four or five matches, and will that get better? I think it probably will. Will it be enough to for him to win a Grand Slam or even two? We don't know. So everybody's got a weakness, and it's whether you face that weakness and are willing to do something about it, as painful as it is. And that's the thing. You know, one of the things that I always say to as coaching or as a player was I looked at myself in the mirror at least once a year, more times if possible. Instead of this New Year's resolution, this is what I'm going to do. I looked at myself and said, okay, what do I need to do now to fix what happened in the last season? And let's get on with it. And I was always determined to, come on, let's go. And I always had a great coach who said, yep, let's get into it. And then what do we need? Sports psychologist. Boom, great. Hire one. What do you need? A trainer. Yep, boom, hire one. Who are these people you're with, Pat? They're my trainer, my sports psychologist. They're what? Who are they? Nobody ever heard of this. You'd be lucky to have a coach with you. But I had these people with me because I had weaknesses.
So what were your weaknesses and what were your strengths?
Well, I think technically, I think forehand was weakness. I think mentally early on, as I said, I lost, as a young fella, I lost lost a match from losing my temper, concentration. So that was something that I needed to do. I had some injuries. So I had a bad back injection and stuff. When I was 19, I needed to be stronger. So I got trainer and Quinn to do that. Obviously, that continued on throughout my career after my peak. I didn't have much of a peak, only a couple of years before I broke my Achilles and everything else. But I turned over every stone that I could possibly find to get better. And then at some stage, technically, you know, my coach couldn't provide that, and I had to go back and rebuild my game, which was really too late. But I rebuilt my game I hit the ball better now than I did during Wimbledon. Hard to believe, I know. Can't move as well, don't focus as well, but I hit the ball better than I did when I won Wimbledon now.
Pat, when you were a kid, one of the greats of Australian sport was Margaret Court.
Mm.
She's now a polarising figure in Australia, in tennis particularly. Have you got a view? Have you got a stance on what she's doing how TA are handling it?
I think she needs to be acknowledged as a superstar player that she is, irrelevant of her stance. In whatever it happens to be, people may not want to recognize her because of that. I was a big fan of hers. I followed her. I actually copied my slice backhand off her. I knew Stan Nichols, who was her trainer. I trained with Stan. He was a fitness guy. So she was a bit of a hero of mine, and I actually really enjoyed speaking to her. I don't agree on a number of things that she speaks out against, her opinions. But that's her opinion. We all have them. They're like assholes. We all have one. But, she's here to be acknowledged as a great tennis player. And, you know, whether she it goes into a different field, which she's obviously, that's her life. She's a minister now, and she may start talking about that. And I think that'll open up a can of worms. I hope she doesn't do that, because I'd like her to be acknowledged as a real superstar and the first woman who truly became a super athlete and super fit, super strong, 6'1", trained like a man. Stan used to say she could train as hard, as strong as Emo or any of these guys that were the legends of Australian tennis. She was as strong as all of them. She used to jump as much, she used to do double knee jumps, double skipping. She was unbelievable.
And do you think the sport is going to have to deal with the fact that eventually transgender men are going to want to insert themselves into the women's game, and then all hell will break loose with the people who think...
I'm not too sure. I know,
I don't want to get you to make it...
That's already happened.
Well, with Renee Richards?
Yes,
no, yes but, it did
but,
happen.
But
yeah.
That's 40 years ago.
Well, that still has happened.
That's but yeah. In this woke day
it's
and
interesting,
age,
isn't it?
Donald, it's about to happen in every sport, and every sport, including the Olympics, is going to have to deal with it at some stage and make a policy about it. Don't give an opinion if
I don't really know, but I think if you're physically advantaged by having testosterone in your system and you produce muscle or you've grown bigger because of that, then that's got to be you know, and that's one of these they did that with the South African runner, didn't they? They gave her estrogen to lower her testosterone.
Castor Semenya.
So it's interesting, isn't it? But she's saying, well, this is the way I am. You know, I can't help it. I was born with high testosterone. I wasn't born a man. I was just born with more testosterone, and that's the way I am. Surely, you know, you could say, well, Roger Federer's balance is unbelievable. He's a freak. Oh, well, let's put a wobble board on under him because he's a freak. He's got balance like nobody else. Well, that's unfair. He's got great balance. Let's put him in wobbly shoes. You know what I mean? It's weird.
So what about the performance? Is a performance-enhancing drugs or recreational drugs big in the sport, or do they turn a blind eye to it like they do in our game, Australian rules?
No, they test it all the time. And I hear this all the time from loads of people. Well, Rafa's this, Rafa's that. You know, I don't know anybody's been drug tested more than Rafa. I mean, it's all the time. You know, and that's the first thing. They go, oh, what about Rafa? I go, no chance. No chance.
Is this performance enhancing or recreational drugs?
Performance enhancing, I'm guessing. Yeah. You know, because people say, oh, like, how can he be so strong and he keeps coming back from those matches? Well, you know, maybe he's a freak as well. And I think he probably is. From what I understood, talking to some of the Spanish guys as a junior, he got tested at the Olympic facility there, and they said he was 15. They said they've never seen anybody with that speed, the speed of a 100-meter runner, speed and agility, and the same as a 10,000-meter runner, an endurance.
So he had endurance as well as power.
Yeah, he's just a freak. And sometimes you come across those freaks, and they celebrate. Exactly, as I said. They said they've never seen anybody in adults, let alone as a 15, 16-year-old who could do this. And I'm just like, we don't know what to say. This is just unbelievable. So he's just a kind of a bit of a freak. And so people go, oh, he's on drugs. He's not on drugs.
Talking about 15-year-olds, if you were Coco Gauff's father, would you let her play on the circuit?
Well, they got restrictions at WTA, so she can only play a certain amount. I think she's a very good player, and she will be, you know, the top handful of players in the world. There's just, you know, I
You're
just
not worried
cast
about
my
burnout?
Mind. Well, they don't let them burn out. That's what the WTA are very clever about. I mean, I just cast your mind back not very far. And if you're British, which I spend a lot of time in Wimbledon and commentate in London, living in London, commentating at Wimbledon. Laura Robson was a girl. I don't know if you even remember Laura. She was the next greatest thing. She was all over the front pages when she won Junior Wimbledon, all over the news. Serena won Wimbledon. It was a little small thing in the back page. So, Serena wins Wimbledon. But Laura Robson, our new superstar. Do you remember? You don't know her, do you? That was it. Yeah. Big mistake. Bernard Tomic, several years ago, they let him on as a young player, put him on centre court, said, right, you know, he's gonna be the next superstar. They threw him on centre court a couple of times. I think he might have won one and lost one of the matches. But he was the next big superstar. You can't put too much pressure on these kids, you know? There's two of them have just... Laura, you know, is in and out of injuries, and I think from what I believe is, you know, it's just not motivated to get better, and neither's Bernie. So they've just been, you know, their brains have been...
Of course, the disappointment to all of us, Don, was that Anna Kournikova could never have been number one in the world because
she made more money than any of
them. Filled the stands day in, day out if she could have actually played.
Well, made more money than any of them. Pat, are you coaching?
No, not this year, no.
You're not coaching juniors or anything?
Well, I'm still working. I was just on the court with a young tour hopeful for a couple of hours this morning, and I'll continue to do that. I love doing that. It's actually... probably my greatest passion.
And what about the percentage of dropout? How many guys actually reach that pointy end? Oh, what's mate. The percentage?
Nothing.
Is it 1%?
Yeah.
And there's a great big...
Yeah, there'd be something like 1% of kit players. And no, I wouldn't even think that. It would actually make a living out of tennis. And you've got to get to really consistently the top 70 in the world to make, be able to make
you
a living.
You mean 99% wouldn't make a living out of it?
No. Yeah, I have kids who come there and play international junior tournaments.
So how do they get around the world from tournament to tournament?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. You know, you get sponsorship from your tennis association or backing or parents. Or it's a really, you know, you see Tsitsipas, who is I think, the next big player, Stefanos Tsitsipas from Greece. I think he's definitely got he's a real deal. He'll win Grand Slams. You know, I remember several years ago, his father sort of grabbed me and said, you know, can you look at him? Can you, you know, he's playing on the grass. I was too busy to actually get on the court with him. But he said, listen, can you talk to Tennis Australia? We change our nationality because we can't, he was struggling to get backing, to keep going. He said, it's too expensive for us. But they found a way. And he knows that every time he gets on the court, he's privileged to be able to go out there and make a big check. And I think the hunger that he has, as the hunger is a lot of from the Eastern Europeans, shall we say, it surpasses the softer nations, and I include Australia in that softer nations. Though, you know, we do have some great determined players like Ash Barty, who can, you know, but the Americans typically, gee, they're, you know, they're soft in general.
Is that why some of the
French are soft?
Europeans are migrating to Australia.
Not just the French players, not the French people.
What about the women that are migrating to Australia? Is that because they're getting backing from Tennis Australia? They can't get it from their native country?
Yeah, there's very few nations that tennis associations that have money, to be honest. There's the Grand Slams do. You know, but even the, you know, a big tennis nation who love tennis, like the Italians, the Italian Open, and they have various tournaments, they really struggle as a tennis association. So they put a lot of tournaments on. They just put loads of tournaments on, and they, as opposed to giving them money, you say, look, we're going to put lots of tournaments on. If you're good enough, you'll do well. And that's really worked. We've seen so many Italian guys and the previous generation, Italian women, come through, that's kind of a winning formula. And Tennis Australia is starting to look at that, go, you know what, maybe we don't need to actually give these guys money, though they don't give a lot of money, I've got to be honest. Considering the expenses, they don't. They're not, you know, they're having their hand out, but they're saying, well, maybe we'll just put loads of tournaments and get them to, you know, Bendigo and wherever, Wagga Wagga, Newcastle, and loads of tournaments, and if they're good enough, they'll make it. And
Pat, are we entitled to claim Di Manure as an Australian?
Yeah.
We are we?
Yeah, why not?
Doesn't he live in Spain?
Yeah, I think he lives in Spain and grows up. But
hasn't he been there for years?
Yeah. Got a bit of an accent, Aussie accent.
So
and he likes Vegemite. I think that's a pass, okay, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Right, so we bang just finally, Mick. Yeah, I know you got to go.
Very good, hasn't he?
But it's very,
very good.
Well, really,
but it is true. You can't stay in Australia and expect to be an international tennis player.
So yeah, Pat, okay. We bang on, Mick and I, about climate. And you have a environmental charity called Planet Ark, I believe?
I'm not involved in it now.
But you started it?
30-something years ago.
And what's your strategy on just... What did you start that for?
For exactly this reason.
Well, what reason?
For global warming. Our big campaigns were...
Hang on. Just don't clap. We have these...
Recycling was huge. Our campaigns... The older people will probably remember Cards for Ark, Cards for Planet, Christmas Cards for Planet Ark, yeah. Recycle Your Christmas Cards, National Tree Day.
Yep.
That was the couple
can't
of
Can't buy
big
your
ones.
Washing powder in
washing
the
Washing powder.
Yeah, but you can't buy it anymore. I was buying it and you can't buy it
anymore. That's because we left the company and I don't know what they're doing now. I don't really know. We had a conflict with it. So we started up a company, another one called Do Something, which is a community-based. It's environmental, but it's also volunteer sort of stuff. So we've done the plastic bag ban, we've done tap water campaigns. So stuff you probably go, oh yeah, that's what people are drinking. Right there, you've got tap water as opposed to. So we're very proud of that. I might sort of sit in the background these days, but it's something we started and you know, obviously, it's a horrible thing, but it's in our face now, and you know. It's sort of got to happen to America. There's something before, you know, various people wake up and Donald Trump goes, oh, okay, a bit like, Scott Morrison does.
Trump.
You know, but wake up. The deniers, a bit of a wake-up call was in their face and they can't deny it.
Brilliant. What about the T-shirt you've got on? Country needs people. What does that mean?
Well, I support an Indigenous foundation called Children's Ground, which are based up in the Northern Territory. I've seen their great work. So I suppose I got a bit of bad publicity or publicity or whatever it happens, whatever you want to call it. Certainly bad. It's sort of changed for saying that I won't celebrate 26th is Australia Day. I said it's got to be a day for everybody. So we move it to the 27th or 28th, then I think everybody can celebrate. I think it's too much pain for the Indigenous people. Not all of them. I don't speak for everybody, but certainly the ones that I've spoken to. So, but anyway, that's beside the point. I'm just a great supporter of this group, Children's Ground, and this coaching and charity stuff is sort of what I do now. I really enjoy it. I think it's you got to give back a little bit.
This has been fantastic. I was going to ask you about just how you're tracking square at the minute. I know you've had A.B. Christensen and Miss Bendit.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. And you have some ex-wife. Children with her. I met Bob Carmichael's wife, Teresa. She said she saw you in the gym and she said you met your current partner, who is an aerobics instructor.
He's very taken with
both of you.
Yoga, yes, right. I'm very happy. I've had back surgery and knee surgery in the last few months, but I'm a great goal for me to get fit, get back again, and you know, I'm enjoying myself. So,
well, mate, we've really enjoyed you coming in here. It's been
thank you. It's always
fantastic,
great to see you guys.
Listening to you, speaking to a real star, Mick. Thank you for staying on. We had a bit of a mix-up with the times. Pat was meant to be here, so no, it wasn't your fault.
Apologies.
Mick stayed on against. He's had tremendous dinner pressure put on him or lunch pressure, so he's had to go. So thank you very much indeed, Pat Cash.
Thanks, guys.
Play our music, Jack, please.
Sorry, guys.
I'm open around streets late at night. I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again. I'm just crazy about you, babe.